A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues on Share Radio with me, Georgie Frost, on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston, making that pound in your pocket go a little further. Now this is the time of the week where we welcome the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. This morning I've got editor Simon Lambert and journalists Ed Monk and Amy Andrew here to discuss the stories that they've been investigating this week that affect us and that pound in our pocket, including Russia. What on earth is going on over there? And why does it matter to us here? Where should you move if you want to get a serious hike in your pay? Plus, who are the companies charging savers shocking management fees to look after our pension pots? Well, good morning to the three of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We often talk also about money-saving tips here on Consuming Issues. You guys have helped us along that. Thank you very much for that as well. But we don't want to scrimp on quality. Oh, no. So we investigate how the discounters compare with higher-end supermarkets. Oh, yes, I introduce to you the great festive Share Radio This Is Money taste test. It's not official at all, just a bit of fun to see if the team from This Is Money can taste the difference between the budget and luxury Christmas food. Oh yes, we put them to the test, Sprouts and all. I can see your faces lit up there with wonder and anticipation. I'd like to put in a little caveat here. I haven't cooked anything apart from the Sprouts, and those are pretty badly, so any food poisoning is totally down to not me. So we are asking today, more generally, what are good quality, last minute, Christmas money saving tips? Annie?
Well, apart from my own one about making your own Christmas cards.
To which I'm holding up a beautiful card which Annie made for me. There we go. I'm not very good at describing it. It's
got stockings on it.
Yeah.
It's a bit sparkly.
It's brown and there's stocking bits. But it's really beautiful.
Simon doesn't look very impressed.
I think it looks
That's
really
Simon's
nice.
Face. Don't be mean. It is beautiful, isn't it? That the time it took you and she bought 50 of these for £11.
Yeah. Do you know what? 50. We actually had a party. It was amazing. We had mulled wine. We all sat around the table. There was about 10 of us. And so we went crazy.
You can make money saving fun.
Yeah, exactly.
So is there some things you shouldn't scrimp and save on, or is there some things that you should? What have people been saying?
Okay, so Mandy has said, Secret Santa for the family, set a price limit. Takes all the stress out of it. Ross says, don't go nuts over food. Every year in our house, we are dining out on mince pies until February. And Phil says, use your Radio Times Christmas edition to wrap presents with. It's quirky. It's original.
It is, but you don't know what's coming on TV.
That's a really good point. Mm. He's not thought that one through.
No, error. And someone else also said, don't spend any money, that I noticed on Twitter.
Wow.
Well, that is a money-saving tip
Isn't it?
So, please, can I get your last-minute money-saving tip? Simon?
I quite like the idea of wrapping the presents in the Radio Times, and I will admit that I have, in the past, wrapped my family's presents in newspaper, which, as a journalist, is a suitable thing to do. You're just going to get, like, ripped up, you know? But I'd say, going on the making-your-own-card thing, if you've got children, which obviously are not a money-saving object normally, you can get them to make something for someone for Christmas and they'll love it. They'll absolutely love it.
Is that a dad thing to say?
It occupies the children and the relatives love it. They love a present from the little kid.
Yeah. And yourself, Ed? Any tips?
For presents and cards? Well, maybe do away with cards.
Money, what we were just talking about there, Ed.
In terms of Christmas cards, I've personally never been bothered about Christmas cards, so maybe do away with them completely. You might want a present, you know.
Amy, your money-saving tip?
It's got to be make your own presents. last year, actually, I made Christmas hampers with sort of pickled the onions and made some chutneys and things like that. And it's much cheaper than kind of going out and spending lots on expensive gifts. And also it's sort of, you know, personal. So, yeah.
Thank you very much for your money-saving tips. Do keep coming in.
On London Digital and online, this is Share Radio.
Well, let's turn our attention then to more serious matters and focus thousands of miles away, in fact, to the current situation in Russia. and why it might affect you. In a nutshell, Russia's central bank raised interest rates at 17%. The rubles continue to plummet. Oil prices down. It's fueling fears of an economic crisis. David Cameron has warned Russian President Vladimir Putin that the EU will keep pressure up on Moscow over its actions in the Ukraine. He spoke at the end of an EU summit last night in which leaders imposed more sanctions against Russia.
On the vital issue of Russia and Ukraine, we also had a very good discussion and unanimous agreement. We should keep those sanctions in place, keep that pressure on until Russia changes its behaviour and stops the aggression in Ukraine.
Simon, first of all, a couple of stories on the This Is Money website that focus on the current situation. Not something we'd automatically assume, something that we'd be discussing today. So first of all, what on earth is going on in Russia and why does it impact us here?
Well, Russia is one of the world's biggest economies. So whilst there might be a certain amount of schadenfreude from people about thinking that Vladimir Putin is getting his comeuppance, what happens there matters. Because the economy is in crisis. The ruble has been crashing. At one point on Tuesday, during the day's trading, it was down 36%, which is a huge move for a currency. The oil price has obviously been plummeting, which is hampering Russia a lot and causing a lot of these problems because Russia is an oil-based economy. And then you combine that with the fact that they've got these sanctions going on post invading the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And it's fairly safe to say that the Russian economy is in crisis. And up until, say, a week, 2 weeks ago, possibly people were slightly surprised by the resilience that Russia had shown. And then all of a sudden it's come to a head. And that sent stock markets around the world gyrating wildly. We saw an incredibly swift and breathtaking fall in the markets in the first sort of couple of weeks of this month. So everyone's been talking about the Santa rally, and instead we got the Scrooge slump.
Very good.
But then things have then bounced back in the opposite direction this week. And the reason why this matters to people is because the movements of the stock market affect your wealth, they affect your pension, and also the movements of the global economies. Those are all very much interlinked nowadays. And so if Russia is in crisis, then you can be fairly safe to say that's going to have a knock-on effect on Europe, that's going to have a knock-on effect on the States. And so when people are looking at these things and thinking, oh, well, that's miles away, it doesn't matter to me, it actually does.
But does it impact us as much as, say, problems with the EU that we're hearing quite a lot about? Because we don't actually do a lot of trade with Russia, so how does it impact that way?
Well, so if you look at how this is all linked up, we don't do a huge amount of trade with Russia.
Mm.
Germany does quite a lot of trade with Russia.
Indeed.
Italy does quite a lot of trade with Russia. That quite a few of those European countries do quite a bit of trade with Russia. And the peripheral European countries, the ones that are towards Russia, also do a lot of trade with Russia. Now, those sanctions, the problems going on in Russia, impact on those economies. So the German economy is suffering a slowdown, part of which is being driven by the problems with Russia. And then that feeds through to us here because we do a lot of trade with Europe. And also the US does a lot of trade with Europe, the US does a lot of trade with us, and so it's all interlinked.
A lot of all of this is related to the price of oil.
Yeah.
Now, this is something that's in the news a lot at the moment. Just explain to us the situation around where we're at there and why this particularly impacts Russia so much.
Well, the oil price has plummeted from basically $100 a barrel around about the start this year to $60. Now,
it was 115 as recently as June. So bearing in mind, it dipped under 60.
Yeah.
But why is Russia so impacted at this?
Because Russia is essentially an oil economy. Over the last, an oil and gas, oil and resources economy. And over the recent years where Vladimir Putin's been in charge, instead of sort of reforming the economy, making the economy more open and trying to encourage, less of a reliance upon those things, the economy has become more closed and there's been more of a reliance upon that oil and resources. I mean, nobody expected the oil price to plummet quite as quickly as it has done. And people are looking at this and going, well, this is a bad sign. This shows up weak global growth. It indicates, a global economy that's on the edge again.
How much does it reflect that? Or how much does it reflect that perhaps people were finding alternate ways when the oil prices were so high?
Well, I think that what's interesting is that it's an indication, people say, of very weak global demand, and this is bad. Mm. This is bad news. But actually, the oil price managed to rise to over $100 a barrel whilst there was also weak global demand. So maybe it went up far too fast at a time when the world wasn't doing too well. And then it's come crashing back down. I mean, ultimately, for most people, for the consumer in this country, this is good news because petrol prices are falling, putting more money in people's pockets.
We've seen the third biggest drop in 25 years in petrol prices. And according to the AA, average prices in the UK have been cut by nearly 7 pence over the last month. Let's just hear from oil analyst Bruce Bullock.
If it were to rebound, let's say in the first half of 2015, up to $65 or $70 a barrel, I think on balance it will help the recovery. If it were to drop further, I think it'll harm the recovery.
We can see why, I suppose, Russia and the oil prices all affect. Was it, just to recap, was it a perfect storm, I guess, with Russia, of all these things happening at once? Anyone that was looking at Russia knew that from the last couple of years, the economy hasn't been doing as well. But Putin's been, you know, very popular in the polls. But then with sanctions and then, of course, counter-sanctions and oil prices, is it just this perfect storm which has just blown up at this time? I'm just wondering why we are seeing such an explosion in terms of interest rates particularly. That was a big surprise. And a huge hike.
It is a huge hike, and it's straight out of the central banker's textbook. That is, when your currency is crashing, you basically hike interest rates.
Yeah, what was the thinking?
Well, the thinking is that basically that encourages money to stay in the country and stay in rubles because people are earning a much higher return on those rubles. So, you know, you take, for example, our interest rates are currently 0.5%. And the money that you're going to be earning, you know, on central bank deposits in this country is 0.5% compared to 17% in Russia. So it's trying to stop people pulling their money out of the country. One of the other problems that they've had is that also, with all the stuff that's been going on with the sanctions, there's been a lot of liquidity being pumped into the Russian banks by the Russian central bank to try and keep money moving around the economy. And that keeping money moving around the economy is very important. And that's frozen up as well. And so they kept pumping money in to try and deal with that. But that obviously weakens your currency more. So now they're going to have to start thinking about tightening that as well. And then this plummet in the oil price has come as the OPEC, the oil producing cartel, basically decided, rather than trying to put a floor under the oil price and stop pumping so much oil, they would just let it fall and continue pumping the same amount of oil. So there's more supply than there is demand, and the price is falling. And also, you've got to remember that this is hugely exacerbated by the large amount of trading that's going on. You know, the people are trading oil, trading the oil price. They're betting the oil price will keep falling. They're trading the ruble. They're betting the ruble will keep falling. And there's a huge amount of money washing around the world that does this kind of things, and that really shunts markets quite a lot, probably in a way that it didn't do as much 20 or 30 years ago. There are hedge funds out there looking at the ruble going, here's an opportunity to make some money. We're going to bet that this is going to go lower. But you can guarantee there'll be some out there buying the ruble as well, going, this has been oversold, and we bet that it's going to bounce back up.
How long is this likely to last? Are there any green shoots for Russia? And how serious do you think is this risk of a meltdown?
It's really difficult to say, isn't it? You can't predict the future. But I think that there's a suggestion that it's not going to be over quickly in terms of the problems that Russia faces, especially because obviously we've heard there's, you know, the sanctions are going to continue. And it's important to remember that, you know, Russia annexed part of another country, which, you know, other countries around the world are not particularly happy about, understandably. That sort of lies at the root of those sanctions. So they're probably not going to get lifted. But it's probably likely that, you know, this can't continue in the way it's been continuing for the last week, for much longer, without something major happening.
It links on, though, to a story that I've also noticed on thisismoney.co.uk, by your good self, and that's the world's cheapest and most expensive stock markets, where the UK stands, but also where Russia stands. Explain to us about this.
Well, the idea behind this is that, essentially, if you look at stock markets around the world, one way of deciding where to invest is not to invest in the ones that look like they're doing the best at any given time, but actually to invest in the ones that look like they're the best value. So actually what you're looking for is the world's cheapest stock markets. So the world's worst stock markets, you should put your money in those. And there's research that's been done, you know, looking back over time, that shows that if you buy what's called value, so you buy something that's cheap, The price will be beaten down. The price will be beaten down for a reason. Mm-hmm. But eventually, that price should move back upwards. And by doing that, you are increasing the probability of doing well. If you buy something that's expensive, well, it's already expensive, the price could keep going up for a while, but ultimately it's likely to fall. Now, this is a difficult thing for people to get their head around because it involves sort of holding your nose and investing in somewhere like Russia. Now, the problem with doing things like this is that if you just go for the cheapest stock market, i.e. Russia, well, Russia's stock market was cheap in 6 months ago. And if you'd have decided to go all in, invest a load of money into a Russia fund 6 months ago, you'd now be down 50%. So cheap things can get cheaper.
Yes, of course.
So you need to spread your risk. So we've done some work with a US investor, a guy called Meb Faber, who actually runs an investment strategy over there that involves basically an ETF, which is a type of fund that invests in the world's cheapest stock markets. And the idea is that over time, that should outperform. And his suggestion is that people need to be investing in a basket of these stock markets. You can't just be investing in one or two. You need to be investing, say, across 10 or the cheapest quarter of stock markets. And then you basically allow you give it the time to work. So you don't want to be chopping and changing all the time. Then you should sort of outperform over the years. Now, obviously, that's quite a difficult thing to do for most people. It's very difficult to actually access all of these things. You need to be investing through funds or exchange-traded funds or trackers because you probably can't be going and buying shares directly in Russia. But the good news is actually that, you know, the UK stock market is quite fairly valued. It sits nicely in the middle.
You spoke about ETFs. Should we find out a little bit more about ETFs?
If you've planned to go out for dinner, then surely you've come up against the question, where shall we eat? So many choices, so many decisions. Chinese, Italian, Indian, Mexican. Well, why not have them all? Granted, tandoori-flavoured chow mein fajita pizza sounds disgusting, but in the stock market, it's not too bad of an idea. Buying an exchange-traded fund is like not being able to make your mind up between Chinese and Indian food, and buying both. That's because you're not buying a single share, but a part ownership of a collection of lots of different shares, all operating in different industries, with different strategies, and appealing to different tastes. It's a similar idea to investing in a unit trust, which also gives you a stake in lots of different companies. One of the main differences between an exchange-traded fund and a unit trust is that an exchange-traded fund, or ETF, is a share that can be traded like any other. In technical terms, the ETF combines the valuation feature of a mutual fund or investment trust, which can be bought or sold at the end of each trading day for its net asset value, with the tradability feature of a closed-end fund, which trades throughout the day at a price that may be more or less than its net asset value. While ETFs may sound like a confusing mix of different shares, they can offer a lot of people very efficient access to investments. The fees are low. There's no stamp duty for shares purchased in exchange-traded funds, and it provides the investor with the ability to place money in a wide variety of shares in one easy transaction.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues. I've got in the studio with me editor Simon Lambert of This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, and journalists Ed Monk and Amy Andrew as well. Earlier, before that little break about ETFs, I was speaking to Simon about Russia, which then moved us on to the world's cheapest and most expensive stock markets and where the UK stands. And you were just telling us, well, right in the middle, Simon.
Yes, that's good news. So we measured the stock markets across a number of different measures, one of which is something called the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, which, not to get too jargony about, measures basically a company or a stock market's earnings, so the profits it makes versus its price, but does it this over a long-term period, so over 10 years. And the idea is that that means that you smooth out all the cyclical stuff that you get from boom and bust. And you can look at where a country stands now versus where it stands against other countries or where it stands against its own median level and see whether it looks cheap or expensive. So against other countries, the UK stands about sort of halfway down. The most expensive one is the US, which is the stock market there has done very, very well, but it's very expensive at the moment. And also against its median level, the UK is below that at the moment. So the UK's level at the moment is 12.5, and its median level is 14.7. So basically what that says is looked at over this long period of time, the UK stock market looks pretty good value. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that it's run out, fill your boots, kind of this is super cheap. It's not in the super cheap sense that it was after the financial crisis crash. But if you're that kind of long-term, steady investor that actually most people are, maybe putting away money every month, investing over time with a long-term sort of period that you're looking at, then this looks pretty good for you. So this looks like you should get decent returns over the next 5 to 10 years.
I suppose that's good for the individual, but also I suppose good for the country. We want it to encourage investment in this country.
Well, it is good for the country because, you know, it's good for companies to see their share prices rise. It's good for people because, remember, there's a lot of onus put onto the stock market nowadays for our pensions. People are investing into defined contribution pensions where your pot is invested in the stock market and your ultimate retirement fund will depend on how well you do. And the UK stock market, if you look at the FTSE 100, has basically never regained the peak level that it made just before the millennium, at the top of the dot-com boom. So once you take into account dividends, if you've taken those dividends and reinvested them, you are actually up. But on that plain price level, it's never got past that. So people look back at it and they go, this just doesn't look so good. But actually, if you look to the future, then, you know, the probability is that you should do better.
So in sum, Simon, the advice for anyone thinking of investing?
There's a number of different options. I think for most people, the easiest thing to be doing is to be investing into funds or investment trusts or simple tracker funds. Because once you start picking individual shares, you need to do your research properly. You need to be looking at the numbers, reading the company reports, and you also need to buy a reasonable number of shares to spread your risk. So the mistake most people make is they basically buy 5 shares and about 4 of them tend to be in companies that all do pretty much the same thing. So they all rise or fall together. But you can also decide to put your money in someone else's hands. So there's, for example, some of the DIY investing places will help you choose a portfolio. There's others that will do all the work for you. I mean, Ed, you did something like this, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, my sort of really disappointing and meagre investments have been made through really, really simple investment platforms where a lot of that asset allocation decision-making is taken off you. I mean, listening to the research, what I think is probably quite encouraging, actually, is that the FTSE 100 and putting your money there in a place where it can essentially track that index, and you can have the option of going into a lower cost investment through a tracker fund. You don't have to go to something exotic that's fund managed. That's good news, isn't it? It means that should be the natural home for beginner. You know, that should be the starting point for investment, really, for everybody. And to hear that it's fairly valued and that it can isn't going to lurch about all over the place, touch wood, is good news.
Journalist Ed Monk and editor Simon Lambert. Coming up, where to move to rake in more pay.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Now, we do like to talk about money-saving tips and how to make money here. Well, a new study out this week suggested the best New Year's resolution may be not just to change jobs, but to up and sticks and, well, go work in another country. The study found that the average professional's starting salary in Switzerland is 2.5 times that of the UK. Well, what would you prefer, a UK starting salary of £27,000 or popping over to Switzerland to bag a £66,000 job? If only it was that easy. Simon, why aren't we all working in Switzerland?
I don't know. Why aren't we all working in Switzerland? I'd actually quite like it because it is cold. I love snowboarding, so I'd love to work in Switzerland. Yeah. Well, it reflects a couple of things. Firstly, obviously, people in Switzerland do earn more money. This is a fact, actually. And I remember my younger sister worked in Switzerland for a few years in a bar and a ski resort, and she got paid about twice as much as you would get paid for working in a bar here. But the cost of living is very high.
Yeah.
So whilst according to this research, the average entry-level professional salary here is £27,000, but it's £66,600 in Switzerland, you can guarantee that that same entry-level professional is going to be paying a lot more for the basics like accommodation, eating, and all those other things. And although actually there was something in this report that said even once you take into account the higher Swiss cost of living, you still end up 20% better off with the Swiss higher salary.
But isn't it because of the type of jobs also you get in Switzerland? Very financial sector related.
Exactly, it probably is. And, you know, there's this, it measures an entry-level professional, but what exactly is an entry-level professional? And you're right, an entry-level professional in Switzerland is probably much more likely to be working in financial services than across the whole of the UK.
Ed?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, and particularly in this research, they've looked at it post-tax and living expenses. I mean, what I don't know if it looked at was things like state provision of things like education and health. You know, I mean, that might impact things as well. So I don't know what the Swiss pay for their health service. They might have to pay that out of their wages as well. That's something that a lot of people, obviously, in this country will rely on the NHS for. So there is more going on behind the figures.
Of course, as they always are with the economics, isn't it?
What's interesting here, actually, is that they also measure the buying power. Mm-hmm. And apparently that gives Britain a serious boost. So if you look at the entry-level professional table out of these 15 major European economies.
Do go to This Is Money online to look at all these graphs as well.
Yeah, then. Yeah. The UK comes in 13th out of 15, which doesn't look particularly good. But Towers Watson, who did this research, said actually once you take into account buying power, then all of a sudden the UK shuffles all the way up the chart to 6th out of 15. And that starts to look a lot better. Mm. And it also talks about this middle manager level salary, which it puts in the UK at £75,000. We look much better on that measure, but also then when you take into account the buying power, that shoves us up on that up to fourth place in the table. But, I mean, I must admit that this middle manager average salary of £75,000 is a huge amount of money. If you earn £75,000 in this country, that puts you in the top percentages of earners. I mean, the other thing that we've also published this week is our best paid jobs table, which is always very, very popular. We use the ONS data that shows the different salaries for all kinds of different jobs. We publish that and people can go look up their job. And there's always that interest, isn't there, of like, I'm going to go see what people get paid for doing my job, and I'm going to go see what people get paid for doing other jobs that are more lucrative. And what's the best paid one? What's the worst paid one? Oh, if I did that, I could get this. If I did that, I could do that. Well, so the most, the best paid are brokers. So our old chums in financial services.
Ed. How disappointing.
They actually
not members of This Is Money journalistic team. They didn't come out top, no.
So a broker, the average salary is £133,677. They actually come above chief executives and senior officials, who get £107,703. Now, obviously, this is a huge amount of money, but it reflects sort of across the board chief executives and senior officials, because we hear about plenty of chief executives for whom £107,703 would be not enough at all. It would be a fraction of their bonus, multiple hundreds of thousands of pounds a year or millions.
You know, these numbers are official, but they're based on people paying PAYE tax. So that basically means, obviously, most of us, but there'll be all sorts of professional people that are paid on a different basis, you know,
of course.
I'm sure for perfectly valid tax reasons. But if, for example, you look at number 65 or 66 on the list, you have vets paying being paid £37,000, which strike me as slightly low, but you might have people who own their own practice that get paid in a different way as the owner of their own business. And they're, in fact, vets on this list are one place behind pipe fitters. So, yeah, you have to sort of, you know, look at it in that context, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is I think one of the ones we spotted earlier when we were talking about this was that at number 39 on the list, we have barristers and judges, and they're getting paid £43,000. That to us, that sounded too low. I know that not all barristers are extremely well paid, but, you know, barristers do tend to be high earners. And judges, we're pretty sure they're not on 43 grand.
And where did you say these stats come from?
These stats come from the Office of National Statistics, but one of the problems that I think occurs with them is that it doesn't potentially reflect whether people are working part-time or not. So it could be that you can actually, you know, multiply those numbers up to deliver what the equivalent of the full-time earnings would be. Because For example, a classic one is that at the bottom of the list is the Lollipop Crossing Patrol. So the Lollipop lady or man. And they earn around £3,400. But obviously, you don't be a lollipop lady or man all day long. It's not a 40-hour-a-week job.
Absolutely. And we spoke earlier to someone who was who wrote scripts for Pantos, and that clearly wasn't his full-time job. Yeah. I don't think that's on the list there.
I don't think we have Panto scriptwriter the list. No,
but
we don't.
Any young people whose parents are encouraging them to become barristers or judges, you can then point this out to your parents and say, no, but that's only 39th on the list. How about I become a tram driver instead? And that is number 28 on £47,000. So do go to This Is Money website and find out where yours is on there. Where's journalists on here?
Oh, he looked at this.
Yeah, we checked that out before.
No, we're 82 on the list.
Get out.
Journalist, newspaper and periodical editors, yes. £34,500.
It does give a good overall indication, though, of like the different jobs. So even though it's part-time and things like that, you know, kind of with the financial services being at the top and things like that is quite good.
It doesn't have broadcasters on here.
No, it doesn't. We're sort of number 351, I think, on that list.
On London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues on Share Radio, on digital, online, and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until 1, making the pound in your pocket. Go a little bit further. Today I've got the editor of This Is Money, Simon Lambert, and journalists Ed Monk and Amy Andrew from the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online with us. Now we're going to turn our attention, if it's okay, to pension savers, with the smallest pots can be exposed to the highest level of charges. That's according to an independent report that was revealed earlier this week. The study of management fees has found that many savers in workplace pension schemes face charges of more than 3% a year. Well, I spoke recently to the pensions minister, Steve Webb, about the investigation into sky high management charges. This is what he had to tell me.
I have to say, when I read that report in the last few days, I was pretty shocked at the scale of what are largely historic high charges. So going forward, we're putting in a charge cap next April. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's put into a workplace pension won't face a charge of more than 0.75%. But obviously what this report shows is there is tens of billions in largely old, not exclusively, but largely old pensions where these charges are still too high. Now, the report set out a timetable for tackling this. I think that's too slow. And so what I've said is I'm going to be calling in the big insurance companies, talking to them about where they are charging people too much, and really trying to get some big, bold response from them. Because mm-hmm. although we can legislate, and indeed we will if we have to, much quicker is if a company announces now that they're going to scrap some charges or cap others, or, you know, and each company is different, each set of products is different, and that's why I'm going to be talking to them. It's a matter of urgency.
So the review's proposal was a 2-year timetable for action. You thought that was far too slow. You said that I think that you would be willing to change the law, but obviously we want to get pensions companies or companies to sort it out themselves. But will you force them to pay any money back?
I think, if I'm honest, that is more difficult, because when pensions were taken out, there was generally a contract signed, there was a charging basis at the time that was legal at the time. So it's sometimes quite difficult to go back and say, we've changed our mind now about what was legal then. Having said that, sometimes you can go back and say, well, was that properly sold? Was the charging information properly communicated? And sometimes those things can be looked into. So I don't think a blanket refund is likely, but if there are particular cases where particular providers didn't communicate clearly with their consumers, then there may be a case for redress.
So, Simon, you were listening along to that. What did you have to make of what the pensions minister, Steve Webb, said there?
I think it's really good to hear Steve Webb talking about getting tough on these charges, because they do matter to people.
Just give us a bit more context around this story, if you would.
Well, in terms of your pension is invested and you are then paying some charges on that. Now, in most company pensions, those charges should be relatively low because obviously a company pension scheme benefits from a huge economy of scale. And ultimately, what you want people to be doing is running the most low-cost pension scheme possible for you, because those charges eat into your returns. And they only sound like a very small amount, but it builds up to quite a large amount over time. But it's always been quite difficult to get people to engage with this because people think, oh, well, 1.5%, that doesn't sound too much. Mm-hmm. Is there really that much of a difference between that and 0.75%? But it actually really does count, especially over that 20, 30-year retirement investment period. And Ed's done quite a lot of research into this.
I'll say, Ed, you wrote an article about this.
Yeah, we did. And, I mean, on that, in terms of how much it costs you, it can be... I mean, it's going to depend on how much you're putting into a pension, but it could be tens of thousands of pounds for a seemingly small difference. A percent or two in terms of charges really, really adds up at the end of it. I mean, this is just more really, really dismal news from these giant life insurance companies that manage things like pensions and long-term investments. It's been an absolutely horrible year for them. I mean, I don't think it'd be too much sympathy, but they've been sort of assaulted from all sides in all sorts of areas of their business. And this latest one, yeah, it's, I mean, to hear the minister there talk about getting tough with them, I mean, they really, the pressure's on them, I think, to just get rid of these charges. And the statements that came out from these large insurance companies about these charges were a little bit disappointing. They, you know, said that their work is in progress. Well, really, all they need to do is find these very high charges and cut them. And that shouldn't be the work of a year or 18 months. That'd be sooner than that.
Well, they're going to have to, aren't they? They're going to bring in regulation that you have to be capped at 0.75% from April next year. Why is it taking so long to do this? How has it been in a situation where the pensions minister, who's been involved in pensions for a long time now, after this report was published, called it jaw-dropping? You'd think that they would know and have done something about this sooner.
That's true, and I think what that speaks to is the fact that these are very, very large but very, very opaque companies. That it's very difficult. For example, the people paying these charges are normal workers, aren't they?
Mm.
And they'll have no. They might not even know that an LNG or an Aviva or whoever is running their pension. They simply pay into their work pension. And the truth is, because they have no idea where their money is going and how it's being run, they're not asking questions and they're not pushing for lower charges. And so you can get a situation where suddenly, you know, the pension minister is surprised that people are paying 3% for their pension.
And I mean, it should be said that Steve Webb is a really good pensions minister.
Yeah.
He really knows his onions. He's really committed to making pensions in this country better. And I think that he has been a massive force for good in the time that he has been the pensions minister. The problem is trying to get people to engage with their pensions and then get these huge investment firms and life companies to tell people exactly what the charges are. And maybe people should be being sent their pension statement every year with, at the top of it, in big letters, that percentage charge, but then it should say in pounds and pence how much it costs them. Because the problem is, people look at 3% and they think, oh, 3%, that's not that much, you know, 3%. But actually, it's a big, big chunk because it's being levied on your entire pension pot.
Mm.
It's not just being levied on the money you've put in that year. It's being levied on the entire pot.
And the work that was published about the charges this week, it's even more complicated than that because we've got people paying a percentage fee, but they might be paying a percentage fee and a monthly fee. And whilst that might not be advantageous for one person, someone else paying into the same scheme under the same charges might be better off. And it's incredibly complicated, and there's an interest and just not aligned.
And one place where it especially hits people is with their old work pension pots. For example, you move jobs and you keep your pension pot at your old work where it remains invested. But actually, in some of those schemes, if you leave the company, your charges go up. So you've got the money sat there in this legacy pension and it's being charged more money than it would be if you were still working for the company. And it's very difficult to find any form of justification for that.
I was going to say, is there any justification for these fees?
Well, it's overcharging. They're not doing any more work for these higher charges.
It's a really interesting... I'd love it, you know, this is what the question that the insurers now face is that, well, why is it because simply these people have been in the dark and you've been able to charge this money? Is that the truth? Or is it that you think 3% is value for money on a very, very, very basic investment? It's either way, it just looks awful.
Is it that some people are getting lower charges because you're overcharging other people?
Mm.
But to be perfectly honest, I think it's just plain old overcharging. And it's been quite easy to hide this stuff, largely because some of these investments are very opaque. It's very difficult to find out what the actual charges are. and also because people just don't pay any attention to what the charges are. And what I would say to people is, if you have a work pension that you're paying money into that is invested, go find out what it's invested in and how much you're paying, because this is your retirement fund you're talking about. And wouldn't you rather have more money in your retirement than a pension company has in its profits?
And actually, this should be less of a problem than it is. And I think things are going to improve, but employers are setting these schemes up. And they should have the wherewithal to have a professional opinion.
How much
say
do you have if it's going through your employer?
You can ask the questions and you can sort of put pressure on them. But it really should be up to employers. Yeah. You might not be expert in this, but they should have professionals in place who can judge whether an investment is good or bad value for their workers. And there is moves in terms of these governance boards that are being set up for pensions to make sure that they have a responsibility to provide value for money. So things may improve, but it just seems to be at a glacial speed.
So in sum, what can you do? You do discover you're on one of these 3%, or you've got an undue charge. What do you do? What's the process now?
Go find out where your pension is invested, and then contact that company and find out what those charges are. Get them to tell you what the charges are on your pension, and do that for your pension you're invested in now and your old pensions. And it might be that you can find that information online. It might be that you have to phone them up.
And the people that were getting treated the worst in terms of these charges were, they were pension pots of under £10,000, which suggests that either it's someone with not very much to save, or probably more likely people that have moved jobs. Mm-hmm. So they've had one pension pot over here, over there, and people forget, frankly. They're maybe a bit more concerned about the ones that they pay into. One thing that's worth pointing out is that even when you know that detail, it might not be completely straightforward. Some pension schemes, even if they charge what seems like a lot, might have benefits in terms of guaranteed rates down the line that you could take advantage of. It's not very straightforward for the ordinary person to work out what to do, unfortunately.
Well, I'm being distracted by the sweet smell of, I'm not sure, Brussels sprouts or cheese. We've got a little bit of a special coming up in a short moment.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Welcome back. Today I've got editor of This Is Money, Simon Lambert, journalists Ed Monk, Amy Andrew from the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, live in the studio, here to discuss the biggest stories of the week. Now we are going to turn our attention then. I can't see what's going on, but I can smell something in the studio, because we decided here we talk a lot about money-saving tips and we talk a lot about the discounters, but can the team tell the difference between the quality of festive fare that you get from your higher end supermarket and your discounter? This is not official at all. And Annie, I can't see because there's a screen in front of me, but what is on the plates in front of me?
We've got a few different plates. We've got turkey. Let's start off with savoury first, shall we? We've got turkey, sprouts.
Where are these from, first of all?
Waitrose, I believe, versus
it is
Lidl.
We went to Waitrose and Lidl. Like, there are other supermarkets out there. Coming into the studio is Consuming Issues reporter Thomas Mason.
He's there to take photographic evidence of this. So what we've got is the budget product on one side of the plate and the luxury one on the other, but you guys don't know which is which. So should we start off with turkey?
So you've just had turkey A. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're about to try turkey B.
Turkey A tasted pretty turkey-ish, mm-hmm. I would say.
Excellent.
You know, didn't taste too bad.
Turkey
B looks a bit more like ham.
Was it something called turkey ham?
And I'm confident it did say turkey on it, but I didn't read very closely. So in that case, the Waitrose versus Lidl turkey test.
I will go with turkey A, because turkey A tasted just a bit more turkey-ish.
Right.
Whereas turkey B looked a bit hammy.
But I'm not sure whether it's actually a trick where it's a very sort of high class of turkey.
I think turkey B tastes better.
Okay,
right.
Turkey B
but
tastes
I'm not completely convinced it is turkey, but I think it's, I prefer it.
Okay, Amy?
Turkey A.
I'll go turkey A.
So turkey A was indeed from Waitrose.
I can tell you that like for like, and I even worked out all the percentages, by the way, turkey from Lidl, £1.37, turkey from Waitrose, £3.44. Let's move on to my favourite. And have we got sprouts? I was up making sprouts yesterday. I can tell you it was about a kilogram of sprouts. I even went as far, and I made Annie's night with this, by working out the percentage of how much you had to throw away with each of the products that you bought. So if you bought a load from Lidl, you had to throw away about a fifth of it. Mm-hmm. Yes, Amy's looking at me like I'm nuts. So bearing in mind also the time it took me to with which to chop them up and get all the rubbish off took a lot longer. So once you got rid of a fifth, I can tell you that Waitrose, though, once you got rid of a few of the bits and bobs, actually weighed more than what they advertised. However, the price was significantly different. Can I have Sprout A or Sprout B? Yes.
I have tried Sprout A. I've broken my normal no-sprouts rules. I've tried Sprout A, but I'm not eating all of Sprout A.
Sprout B?
Sprout B is on its way to me.
We are tasting food from Waitrose and Lidl to see if you can scrimp on food or drink this Christmas. So we've tried turkey. The winner was Waitrose, although Ed Monk did decide that he rather liked the suspicious turkey ham looking fare. That's okay. So Sprout, Simon, you're not a Sprout fan, but your choice.
I'm not a Sprout fan, so they were both pretty horrible. But I'll go, no offence. I'm going to go with Sprout A. I think I should also, at this point, just point out to any listeners that the turkey was sliced turkey, not an actual roasted turkey. It was slices of turkey. So for anyone wondering how we might possibly have confused a roast turkey with a roast ham, we didn't do that. Are slices.
I do have to explain there was a health and safety issue in as much as I didn't trust myself to cook turkey. So, Ed, Sprout A or B?
I'll say Sprout. Sprout A, it's more sort of sprouty, strong sprouty taste.
Okay.
I should say that this is coming from a man who said he was a committed sprout eater.
I'm a committed sprout eater as well.
Definitely committed sprout eater. I'd definitely go for Sprout A.
Okay, what's Sprout A?
So committed sprout eaters should head down to Lidl.
7 pence. Lidl for 100 grams, 63 pence in Waitrose. So basically, I went to Lidl and I got 49p, 750 grams, and £2.09 for 330 grams at Waitrose. So significant difference, although I would like to point out I did have to throw away a fifth of the amount of sproutage in the Lidl product. Let's quickly turn attention to some fine cheeses then.
This is my favourite.
And we have mince pies after that. We always talk about money-saving tips here on Consuming Issues, but should you scrimp on quality or price when it comes to food and drink? Donna Ferguson, we heard earlier, a journalist there, talking about how she doesn't believe you should ever scrimp on Christmas food or drinks. So I've got the team from This Is Money to see if they can actually tell the difference. We decided so far that turkey was better from the higher quality supermarket. Not really surprised there, although Ed, not so sure, the outlier there. Also, if you want to go Sprouts, go Lidl. Now we're trying a cheese selection. A or B?
I will go with cheese B.
Very unscientifically, cheese B.
Again, B.
Cheese B was the Rue Aide Brie de Meur, a bit of a French theme with Waitrose cheese selection. But if you'd have gone for A, you would have got the cheese board thrown in.
Exactly. If you'd have gone for A, you would have got a free cheese board, and A was little, although you picked Waitrose cheese, and I can tell you there, for price-wise, £3.43 for Waitrose, and £1.15 for Lidl. And I can tell you, because I don't think we're going to have time to try mince pies, but it is significantly cheaper if you go to Lidl. Try in some mince pies while I'm talking. 75p for six if you go to Lidl. £4 at Waitrose. Can the team tell the difference? I'll let you know.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.
I am still joined in the studio by editor of This Is Money, Simon Lambert, and journalists Ed Monk and Amy Andrew. We tried cheese, sprouts, turkey slices, well pointed out there, Simon, so not real turkey. That was a health and safety because I didn't want to cook it, but I did cook the sprouts. But you tried mince pies. Can I get from you whether you preferred the Waitrose or the Lidl?
They were slightly different, mince pies. One looked like a very traditional mince pie. The other one had a sort of a bit more of a kind of
Heston effect.
Heston kind
it was
of
a Heston Blumenthal one.
And actually, I would say that I probably prefer the Waitrose one. But the one thing I would say for any makers of mince pies out there is I've always been hugely disappointed that mince pies don't actually have proper mince meat in them. I know that it's called mince meat, but that is not mince. Make me some mince pies with some meat in them. I'd be very grateful.
I think you can get them. Ed, you...
well, I did prefer the Waitrose one as well. Sort of shortbread, gingery, spice thing. Very nice. But
bit of an aftertaste, though.
Yeah, a bit of an aftertaste. But all mince pies are foul, if you ask me. So I don't,
great.
Yeah.
So you hate Sprouts, Simon. You don't like
it. You did a much better job of explaining what that Heston Blumenthal mince pie was than I did, yeah. Where I sort of just muttered and Georgie went a bit Heston-y. And I said, yeah.
Yes, exactly. OK, so far that's two for Waitrose.
I've got to go for the Lidl. I think it's a classic mince pie. I don't want any too much sort of think too many things going on, ginger, all this sort of stuff. Just want a classic mince pie.
There you go. So Ed, for in terms of Lidl, Ed went for the turkey slices but couldn't work out whether they were ham or not. Amy went for the Lidl mince pie. You all went for Lidl Brussels sprouts. The difference in receipts, and I worked out the like for like. If you go to Waitrose, all of our festive fare that we got, sprouts, turkey, mince pies and cheese collection, £11.50. If you go to Lidl, £3.32. So knowing that, how would you therefore spend your money this Christmas? Is it worth scrimping a little bit?
That Lidl stuff is a lot cheaper. And if you magnify that up into the actual cost of a Christmas meal, then I'm imagining if you went to Lidl, you would save an awful lot of money on your Christmas meal. In terms of the cheese, there wasn't that much in it. In terms of the mince pies, as Amy said, those little mince pies were the more traditional one. Sprouts are horrible anyway, so I don't care. And in terms of the turkey versus what was potentially turkey ham, I'm not sure that was an entirely fair test.
It's a good point. So is it Lidl or Waitrose for you?
I would seriously consider going to Lidl to buy some stuff. I agree with what Donna said about you shouldn't skimp on food and drink. Like, yeah. Buy nice stuff. But nice stuff doesn't have to be expensive. Mm-hmm. And that's the crucial point that has been missed quite often in this whole budget supermarket versus the big supermarkets thing, is the budget supermarkets don't just promote themselves on price, they promote themselves on quality first. And there's some really nice food in Aldi and Lidl.
Which is why we wanted to do this taste test. You mentioned the cheese platter board as well, bearing in mind that you get almost double and a free... board with
it. You can't eat the board, though.
You can't eat the board, but you can save it for next year. Ed, for you, Lidl or Waitrose? I would like to point out there are other supermarkets out there.
Lidl, definitely. Value for money. But I might lie about it. No one's going to know anyway.
But you made a good point, Simon, there. Actually, you know, we are just trying bits here. But if you're feeding a lot of people, it will start to add up. Amy, for you?
I think I'll probably get main bits at Waitrose and then all the bits and pieces at Lidl. Kind of go for both.
I'd probably agree with that. For something big like turkey and for meat generally, I don't think you should scrimp on. What I did also get you to try is the champagne. Now, they're on a separate taste test. Waitrose came out top with their bubbly. It was £25. However, Lidl's came second. So it beat Tesco and Sainsbury's. £11.99, Comte de Senneval. Brut champagne, but I can tell you when I got that it was £9.99. No idea why. Can I ask your opinion on the £9.99 champagne?
I thought the £9.99 champagne was very drinkable.
The review was dry and drinkable. What would you want?
But then I happen to think that most people think most champagne is very drinkable, and that actually it's very rare that anyone can really tell the difference between different kinds of champagnes. And so I personally think there really isn't. If you're just going to be that a couple of times a year champagne drinker who's just having a glass because it's Christmas rather than because you're really savouring the champagne, there's probably no need to go out and spend a load of money, get down to Lidl or somewhere.
Yeah. Ed?
Very nice indeed. Particularly even out of the plastic beakers that you've given us to drink it out of. It's delicious. It's lovely.
Yeah, mine went down very quickly. It was lovely. but I would say that perhaps maybe a little bit more fizz.
Simon, you did have a tip about champagne as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about money-saving tips for Christmas. Or also, this is actually a money-saving tip if you're having a wedding or something like that. Is that basically, if you're serving champagne, as I said, most people are just drinking it because they like a glass of champagne at Christmas or a wedding. If you buy something like Blanc de Blanc, which is French sparkling wine, essentially most people cannot tell the difference between that and champagne. And maybe we can do a blind taste test with that sometime. You know, you can buy something that's cheaper than champagne, and you can serve that up and it can save you some money. But to be perfectly honest, you look at some of the deals on champagne and actually it's probably as cheap as some of those replacements.
There are a lot of deals on champagne at the moment. Thank you very much, editor Simon Lambert there, journalists Ed Monk and Amy Andrew. I understand you're off to your Christmas party lunch now. I hope we haven't ruined your appetite too much with our sprouts, especially. I see you've left those on the side. I do hope you're going to clear those up or I'll get in trouble. Thank you very much for joining us.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.